Through a skillful interpretation of scriptures, this professor convinced me that evolution must be false. However, as promised, I soon came into contact with Latter-day Saint scientists who professed belief in the modern evolutionary synthesis. It became painfully clear that these men were not vile apostates, but good Latter-day Saints. Knowing that both parties cannot be right, since truth cannot contradict itself, I began to look for definitive statements on the matter. Searching for an official church position, I actually found two. The earliest had an anti-evolutionist tone, but did not commit to any absolute dogma. The second was somewhat more conciliatory in tone and noncommittal in its conclusions. Through further research, I came to the conclusion that the church has chosen not to commit to matters which have nothing to do with the salvation of the souls of mankind. This conclusion is supported by William Evanson's article in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. According to the official church positions, Mormons can either embrace a literal interpretation of the creation or an evolutionary account of the diversity of life without being in conflict with the future. Appropriate scriptures and authoritative statements by Latter-day Saint authorities will continue to be used by both parties to support their respective positions. It seems highly unlikely that either body will convince the other of the rightness of their respective positions any time in the near future. Despite the official absence of a position supporting or denying an evolutionary hypothesis, Latter-day Saint scholars have noticed an ever-increasing conservative approach to the creation account within the rank and file of the LDS Church. This literalist approach to the creation is difficult to explain without looking at LDS history. Historical circumstances could help to explain the change from an early period of relative speculation concerning the creation to a more conservative approach. The earliest period of LDS history was characterized by an openness to new ideas as Joseph Smith encouraged intellectual inquiry among members of the church. In a public sermon, Smith rebuked some of his more dogmatic followers, whom he believed discouraged the creative thoughts of others. He claimed that this was too much like the Methodists and not the Latter-day Saints. According to Smith himself, Methodists have creeds which a man must believe or be kicked out of their church. Smith wanted the liberty of thinking and believing as I please to be extended to all members of the church. Smith also held secular learning in high regard. This is reflected in the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants, like many of you know. As far as canonized scriptures are concerned, it is in the Doctrine and Covenants that the early LDS attitude toward secular learning is perhaps best articulated. In the Doctrine and Covenants, we read that the saints should obtain knowledge of things both in heaven and in the earth, and under the earth, things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, things which are at home, things which are abroad, the wars and the perplexities of the nations, and the judgments which are on the land, and a knowledge also of countries and kingdoms. This attitude toward secular learning is reinforced in the Book of Mormon, when the Book of Mormon teaches that to be learned is good if one hearkens unto the counsels of God. Smith's views on secular learning and education can be summarized in his inaugural address given on the 3rd of February, 1841, after he was elected mayor of the newly founded city of Nauvoo. In this address, Smith wished to communicate matters of paramount importance, such as the propagation of learning and the utilization of science for the welfare of the citizens of Nauvoo. As mayor, Smith argued that secular learning and applied science were necessary for the success of the city. Secular knowledge, according to Smith, was one avenue that led toward truth. Spiritual truth could be found in the scriptures with scientific knowledge, while scientific knowledge could be found in the study of nature. These truths were both important since they revealed different facets of the mind of God. Knowledge of scientific and scriptural truth could lead to a greater understanding of God, since all truth issued forth from the divine Creator. Smith's successor, Brigham Young, agreed. According to Young, science and religion could not conflict. since they were different parts of the same reality. He stated that our religion will not clash with or contradict the facts of science in any particular. Latter-day Saint theology embraces all truth, and every fact in existence, no matter whether in heaven, earth, or hell, according to Jung, a fact is a fact, all truth issues forth from the fountain of truth, and the sciences are facts as far as men have proved them. Facts obtained from the sciences and facts acquired from revelation are equally genuine and should be accepted as part of the Latter-day Saint gospel. Since God works through natural laws, Latter-day Saints were expected to learn more about astronomy, chemistry, and geology in order to gain a better understanding of the divine. Now, speaking specifically on geology, Brigham Young maintained that geology is a true science, and its leading principles are eternal facts given to man from God as revelation. As a result, Young was willing to accept the contemporary geological belief that this earth has been in existence for thousands and millions of years as a distinct possibility, and he even censured those who refused to believe in the proven facts of geology. He implied that members of other denominations who rejected scientific truth and adhered to the traditional account of Genesis were not ready for the greater truth which had been revealed through science. During Young's administration, many leaders of the church speculated on possible modes of creation, since Joseph Smith left no definitive statements concerning its specifics. Their theories were representative of a period in church history which can be characterized as generally undogmatic in regards to the creation. One of the first to interpret the creation scriptures after the death of Joseph Smith was Parley P. Pratt. A well-known leader of the church, Pratt served as a member of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles from 1835 until his death in 1857. He was also a personal friend of Joseph Smith and well acquainted with his philosophy. In his Key to the Science of Theology, published in 1855, Pratt discussed the creation accounts given by Moses. Pratt argued that when paradise was lost by sin, the heavens were veiled from view, and man was no longer worthy to retain the knowledge of his true origins. Even though the process of creation was later revealed to Moses, his followers were not prepared to hear the true account. Moses was forced to veil the past in mystery. He gave the children of Israel an intellectually satisfying myth developed to explain the origin of life and man while concealing the true process of creation. It's interesting to note that Pratt's resulting interpretation of the Mosaic account is very similar to the stories that parents tell their own children concerning the act of physical procreation. According to Pratt, and this is according to his own words, parents still conceal the mysteries of procreation from their children when they feel that they are too immature to handle the truth. In these situations, parents often relate some childish tale of newborn life, such as a baby spontaneously springing forth from underneath a cabbage leaf. According to Pratt, the creation account given by Moses served a similar purpose. It gave the children of Israel an account of the creation that they were intellectually prepared to hear. Instead of the truth, they were told that man was molded from the earth as a brick, and that woman was manufactured from a rib. Pratt's colleague, Orson Hyde, had his own theory concerning the origins of life. For Hyde, the true account of creation was a question of semantics. In an address given to the saints at a general conference of the church on the 6th of October in 1854, Hyde took it upon himself to interpret the traditional creation account. He began by pointing out that Adam and Eve were commanded to multiply and replenish the earth. He then explained that the meaning of the word replenish is to refill or recomplete. According to Hyde, The world was peopled before the days of Adam. When God said, "Go forth and replenish the earth," it was to replenish the inhabitants of the human species and to make it as it was before. He compared the creation narrative to the story of Noah. According to Hyde, it has been said that Adam and Noah became the respective fathers of new worlds, but it was the same old world still and will continue to be, though it may pass through many changes. After Hyde preached that the world was peopled before the advent of Adam, Brigham Young stood and praised Hyde for his splendid address, from which I do not wish to eradicate any items. These early liberal accounts of the creation eventually gave way to an increasingly conservative approach due to intervening historical circumstances. The encroachment of outside influences upon the isolation of the saints played an incredibly important role in this transformation. Church leaders in the late 19th century and early 20th centuries were forced to confront secular learning with all of its implications for religion as their isolation in the Intermountain West became increasingly jeopardized by westward expansion. With the achievement of statehood in 1896, an increasing number of church members would also be exposed to evolutionary ideas in newly organized state schools. One reaction to the threat of this encroaching secular knowledge was to focus on firm foundations of basic church doctrines and to curb speculation that had characterized earlier periods of church history. In order to combat the outside threat perceived by several Latter-day Saints, a period of doctrinal purification and consolidation began. Attempts to establish official LDS positions and to clarify church doctrines were implemented. During this period, several centrally directed organizations, as well as officially sponsored church magazines, were created in order to ensure that the church members would be unified in doctrine. This was a conscious movement of indoctrination for purposes of protecting the Mormon way of life, which involved a certain surrendering of free thought that characterized earlier stages of church history. This was a critical period in church history, since it was a time of getting back to basics, a time of anchoring church doctrine securely on a conservative interpretation of the LDS canon. An equally important period of accommodation became evident as Utah vied for statehood. Not only did the church align itself with the rest of the nation by prohibiting plural marriage, it also aligned itself more closely to the Protestant majority by diminishing the focus on some of its more radical speculations. In order to survive as an ecclesiastical institution with its own unique theology and religious practices, adjustments were made and theology became less radical. In short, Latter-day Saints created a new paradigm that would save the essential characteristics of their religious tradition and allow them to live in peace with other Americans. Around the turn of the century, speculation regarding the creation was in decline, and spiritual interpretations began to resemble the traditional accounts espoused by the majority of Protestants. In 1909, around the turn of the century, the First Presidency of the Church published its first official statement concerning evolutionary theory. This official proclamation maintained a conservative position without completely eliminating the possibility of organic evolution. Another very important event that contributed to Latter-day Saint conservatism occurred 2 years later after this first official statement was published. In 1911, several professors at Brigham Young University began to teach evolution as truth, which could be harmonized with Latter-day Saint doctrine. Responding to the ensuing controversy, the Church Board of Education decided that it was appropriate to teach only those facts which were firmly established by science and church schools. It was deemed inappropriate to teach evolution since it was impossible to know with any certainty just how much of evolution was fact and just how much of evolution was fiction. The Church Board of Education's decision not to teach evolution in the church schools sent a distinct message to members of the church. By disallowing the teaching of evolution at church schools, it appeared as though the church had further aligned itself with the fundamentalist opposition to evolutionary theory. Consequently, many members of the church began to interpret creation scriptures more literally. The earlier speculative approach to the creation seemed to fade into the past. Now, the Scopes trial of 1925 brought about even more interest in the problem of evolution. By 1925, the first presidency published another official proclamation restating the church's official position. The statement did not say that the creation had taken place in six literal days or even 6,000 years, nor did it reject the idea of evolution. It affirmed that man was created in the image of God, but said nothing of the method of creation. No matter how nonpartisan the church's reaffirmation of its official position was, a conservative reaction to modernism continued to increase after 1925. The life and works of B.H. Roberts exemplified this trend. Roberts' description of the creation, which appeared in his masterwork, The Truth, the Way, the Life, was reminiscent of an earlier period of Latter-day Saint thought. Keeping this in mind, it should come as no surprise that The Truth, the Way, the Life resonates with the same open-mindedness which helped to find an earlier epic. Roberts believed that science and religion were both parts of a universal truth that ultimately came from God. He argued that science and religion could be reconciled since both came from the same source. The Truth, the Way, the Life was Roberts' attempt to harmonize contemporary science with Latter-day Saint theology. It was believed that such an accomplishment would promote the faith of the Latter-day Saints by demonstrating that all truth was compatible. He liked nothing more than to argue that Mormon theology and the most modern science are compatible, and he struggled mightily to demonstrate the truth of this judgment. Roberts wrote that religion, to be effective, must appeal to the understanding as well as to the emotions of man. A conservative reaction to Roberts' creation scenario best illustrates the changing intellectual climate. According to Roberts, men had lived before the advent of Adam. Some leaders of the church took exception to Roberts' pre-Adamite theory, since they believed that it contradicted a literal interpretation of Scripture, as well as official statements made by church leaders. Even though Roberts claimed there was no ancestral link between his pre-Adamites and modern man, future president of the church, Joseph Fielding Smith, attacked Roberts' theory due to its perceived evolutionary implications. Smith's reaction to Roberts' theory is illustrative of a conservative retrenchment. Many Latter-day Saints, including Smith, viewed modernism as a threat since it seemed to attack certain fundamental tenets of their religion. Smith particularly disliked the fact that evolution was being taught in Utah's public schools since, in his opinion, it exposed young adults to potentially faith-destroying and atheistic theories. Consequently, Smith was seriously concerned with Roberts' theory. To Smith, it seemed as if Roberts were attempting to teach evolution as a truth verified by both science and Scripture. This was even more disconcerting considering the fact that Roberts was a general authority who intended to publish his work under the auspices of the church. Not surprisingly, Smith challenged the theory of evolution, which he believed was being championed by Roberts' work. Smith argued that creation accounts in the Scriptures should be taken more literally. According to Smith, scriptural authority was greater than that of science since it came directly from God. After a long and severe struggle with diabetes, Roberts died on the 27th of September in 1933. This left Smith without any dogged opposition to his position among fellow leaders of the church. As a result, Smith published his first attempt to refute the theory of evolution in 1954. In Man, His Origin and Destiny, Smith enlisted the authority of such prominent creationists as George McCready Price and Byron C. Nelson. Responding to Roberts' earlier assertion that the evidence in favor of an evolutionary interpretation of nature could not be ignored, Smith used the tenets of scientific creationism in an attempt to add an air of authority to his arguments. Smith, however, failed to mention that his sources were not taken seriously by mainstream science. Flood geologists have tried to argue for geological evidence of a worldwide catastrophe or a massive change in the earth at the time of the flood of Noah or the advent of Adam and Eve, but they have produced no credible evidence for the kind of event which they postulate. Smith was cleverly clothing his argument in the cloak of scientific authority in an attempt to convince his readers of the truth of his argument. Dwayne Jeffrey, who you will hear from in just a few minutes, writes that for the first time in Mormon history, Mormonism had a book that was openly antagonistic to most science. By opting for schism rather than synthesis, Smith sparked a wave of religious fundamentalism that shows little signs of abatement. Although the president of the church at the time, David O. McKay, repeatedly disavowed Smith's book as the official position of the church, many Latter-day Saints seem to accept it as such. This phenomenon is particularly due to the fact that McKay never publicly denied Smith's interpretation. McKay's procedure was to quietly assure those who inquired of his office that the church had not taken an official position on the issue. Despite McKay's private disavowals, Smith becoming a member of the First Presidency in 1965 and the president of the church in 1970 gave added weight to the belief that his book was actually authoritative and represented an official position of the church. Smith's views gained even greater circulation when they were cited by his son-in-law, Bruce R. McConkie, in one of the all-time bestsellers in Mormon history, Mormon Doctrine. McConkie argued that there is no harmony between the truths of revealed religion and the theories of organic evolution. Like his father-in-law, he circumscribed the existence of life on Earth to a few thousand years, and he relied upon flood geology to make sense of the fossil record. McConkie would later imply that those who believed in the theory of evolution were under the power and influence of Satan. The fact that Mormon Doctrine was written by a church leader with an air of authority meant that it would be taken very seriously. The title itself suggests that McConkie was speaking for the church on matters of official doctrine, though in his preface he clearly states that, "For the work itself, I assume sole and full responsibility." David O. McKay also disavowed Mormon Doctrine as the official position of the church in personal letters, as he had earlier done with Smith's work. Despite McKay's clarification that Mormon Doctrine was not an official exposition, McConkie's status as a general authority, the title of his book, his prolific writing presence, and the fact that there was never an official published opposition to McConkie's work helped to make his views prominent among many contemporary Latter-day Saints. According to the historian of science, Ronald C. Numbers, McConkie's literalism helped to push Mormonism towards fundamentalism and anti-evolutionism. By 1973, 81% of the students at BYU denied that the creation involved evolution at all. After McConkie and Smith had published their respective works, other church leaders continued to raise concerns over the religious implications of evolutionary theory. Joseph Fielding Smith's successor, Harold B. Lee, claimed that quote-unquote, so-called science and communism were two sources of untruth which challenged the faith of Latter-day Saints in two different sermons addressed to members of the LDS Church. Lee's successor, Spencer W. Kimball, reaffirmed the church's official position. However, during his administration, McConkie continued to teach literalist beliefs to members of the church. In an address delivered to BYU students in 1980, McConkie argued that Darwinism was one of the seven deadly heresies that led men away from God and should accordingly be avoided. McConkie's apostolic colleague, Marky Peterson, also raised concerns about the theory of evolution during Kimball's presidency. Shortly after succeeding Kimball as president of the church in 1985, Ezra Taft Benson reread a speech given 11 years earlier when he was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, in which he declared that our families may be corrupted by worldly trends and teachings unless we know how to use the Book of Mormon to expose and combat falsehoods in socialism, organic evolution, rationalism, humanism, etc. The most powerful statement made by a general authority regarding evolution since McConkie, however, has come from Boyd K. Packer. In 1990, Packer wrote, "It is my conviction that to the degree the theory of evolution..." Let me start again. "It is my conviction that to the degree the theory of evolution asserts that man is the product of an evolutionary process, the offspring of animals, it is false. And I am sorry to say that so-called theistic evolution, the theory that God used an evolutionary process to prepare a physical body for the spirit of man, is equally false." He concludes by advising his listeners to rely on the witness of the heavens above when confronted by the evidence in the rocks below. Other evidence of a contemporary literalist approach to the scriptures can be found in current study manuals used by the church's educational system. For example, the present Old Testament manual currently used by institute classes takes a highly literalist approach. On the question of creation, it cites the work of prominent flood geologists in defense of the position that the earth is only a few thousand years old. Concerning evolution, the manual includes several quotes by general authorities as well as the creation scientists that appear to rule out any possibility of a reconciliation between evolution and LDS doctrine. One result of this recent literalism is that BYU students today are at least as literal in their beliefs on evolution as they were in 1973. Despite some evidence for changing attitudes among general authorities reported by David H. Bailey, he asserts that most Mormons remain generally fundamentalists in regards to the creation and the question of organic evolution. In conclusion, it is interesting to note that the statements of 1909 and 1925 remain the only official proclamations concerning evolution issued by the church. Regardless of Smith and McConkie's works to the contrary, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has taken no official stance concerning the theory of evolution. Contrary to the prevailing beliefs among many members of the LDS community, as long as neutrality remains official, individual members of the church are each free to follow their own conscience with regards to the theory of evolution. Those who interpret Joseph Smith's teachings regarding secular knowledge to mean that revelation does not come only through the prophet of God, nor only directly from heaven in visions or dreams, but may come in the laboratory, out of the test tube, and out of the thinking mind and inquiring soul, may still turn to science for help in finding answers in regards to the mode of creation.
Steve wondered what my wife did if I spent my time studying science and church history. You know, I must be a pretty boring spouse, and I probably am, but I played it smart. I married an English teacher, and she spends all her nights and weekends just grading papers, so I can't be accused of ignoring my spouse. I had asked for an overhead projector here today, but I guess Devery was not able to line one up, so I apologize for that, but let's see what we can do in the next few minutes. Tim has documented the public shift to an increasing conservatism and in my feelings of things, I see that Tom Alexander, for instance, documented years ago a very profound shift in Mormon doctrine at the turn of the last century. And I would argue that there is a similar shift being made in the church today. The difference being that the one back then came from the general authorities and from the top. The one today seems to be coming from people who are not even general authorities. But through various publications, they seem to be shifting a lot of Mormon attitudes in the directions that Tim has indicated. I think we must realize that dealing with people's religious views is always incredibly delicate. For many people, religious views are the only anchor they have to try to make sense and meaning in their lives. And you fiddle around with those only delicately if you don't want to get in trouble. For these people, you've got to keep the doctrine pure, as the phrase goes. But that gets to be an immediate concern as, well, what's the pure doctrine to start with that we ought to be keeping pure? And how do you change with a changing world, such as we have today? Views do become obsolete. Anyone who's followed Mormon history, for instance, on such matters as restrictions on priesthood or the doctrine of the gathering, the doctrine of the imminence of the political kingdom or the imminence of the millennium, will be aware that we've had to undergo some major restructuring on some of those ideas. So an organized church, any church, the LDS church in particular, must balance a number of things. One is trying to maintain a doctrinal anchor for members of the church who really need those kinds of anchors. Secondly, however, you've got to avoid getting painted into theological corners that are going to be difficult to extricate yourself from as things change, and they will change. And one would hope that in the midst of all that, you can try to deliver a message that has sociological, intellectual, spiritual substance. We run into difficulty with that many times. I think of the Savior's comment in Matthew 7 and 10, where he says, you know, which one of you, if your son asks for bread, will you give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will you give him a serpent? And yet I find so many of my students who feel that that is exactly what they have been given whenever they try to ask any questions whatever in our organized church structure. And much of that goes back to the 1931 episode that Tim referred to, the dispute between B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith. The first presidency at that time made a formal declaration and ruling to the other general authorities: upon the fundamental doctrines of the church, we are all agreed. Our mission is to bear the message of the restored gospel to the world. Leave geology, biology, archaeology, and anthropology, no one of which has to do with the salvation of the souls of mankind. Leave that to scientific research while we magnify our calling in the realm of the church. Well, that clearly has some unintended, but I think unforeseen consequences. If you are going to tell church leaders to confine themselves only to a scriptural base, this means that you will find it more and more difficult to extend that scriptural base into other areas of life. This means that you progressively narrow your view, and of necessity, it's going to take you into a more conservative position on scriptural literalism, even though that has not been the historical position of the church. That scriptural literalism, however, does afford an opportunity to use scripture as a hammer to beat science or academics of any sort or anything that doesn't happen to match your particular view. All you need to do is just get up and read something literally and insist that this is correct and it rules out any other ideas. You don't need to even refer to the other ideas, and you're making your point. But anyone else who wants to look at, say, a James E. Talmage point of view or a John A. Witzel point of view would be accused of, well, you're talking about science and going outside the First Presidency's dictum if you tried to make affiliations. So there's an institutional structure here that is getting us into some real problems. As Tim has indicated, there have been a number of cases in church history where individuals make public statements, they get private reprimands or corrections or whatever else it may be, but it still leaves the public record with the point of view that these anti-science individuals frankly wanted to make. And so I thought today that I might share just a few of the things that we have found useful in working with some of our young people who find that, you know, they've asked for a fish and they've been given a serpent. We try to say, well, this is the church's public statement, all right, but, you know, this is what's gone on behind the scenes, and they want to say, well, what goes on behind the scenes? So I thought I might take just a few of those this morning, but we still want to leave time for audience discussion. Joseph Fielding Smith and James E. Talmage, of course, got into a very, very interesting ruckus back in 1931. And the first presidency ultimately ended up taking James E. Talmage's position, which argued for long ages of the earth, death going on for millions of years, and publishing that in a pamphlet published by the church as, frankly, a direct counter to Joseph Fielding Smith's published statements that argued oppositely. In more recent times, Joseph Fielding Smith, in publishing his Man, His Origin, and Destiny in 1954, was then subject to a series of letters from President McKay writing to anyone who seemed to have asked. No, that book is not the official position of the church. It contains the author's views for which he alone is responsible. It was not considered by, authorized, or approved by the church. The same for Bruce McConkie's Mormon Doctrine. But let me spend a little more time on that particular one, since, as Tim has indicated, it's had such massive distribution and influence. The book was published, of course, in the late 1950s, and by January 28th of 1959, President McKay approached two of the apostles, Mark E. Peterson and Marion G. Romney, and said, "Will you review that book for me and tell me what you think's going on?" Elder Romney reports, "The nature and scope and the authoritative tone of the style of the book pose the question as to the propriety of the authors attempting such a project without assignment and supervision from him whose right and responsibility it is to speak for the church on Mormon doctrine, i.e., President McKay. Had the work been authoritatively supervised, some of the following matters might have been omitted and the treatment of others modified." And then he just goes on with a series of items that he finds problematic in the book. Many of them have to do with Elder McConkie's treatment of other churches, particularly the Catholic Church. Elder Romney is bothered about the declaration as to Mormon doctrine on controversial issues such as pre-Adamites, the status of animals and plants in the Garden of Eden, meaning of the various accounts of creation, and so on. He raises these as definite problems. By January 7th of 1960, in President McKay's letter books, we find, for instance, on that date, entries about regarding the book Mormon Doctrine. The first presidency met with Elders Mark E. Peterson and Marion G. Romney. They submitted their reports on the examination of the book Mormon Doctrine by Elder Bruce McConkie. Elder Peterson stated that the extent of the corrections that he has marked in his copy of the book, 1,067 of them, affect most of the 776 pages of the book. "It is agreed that the necessary corrections are so numerous that to republish a corrected edition of the book would be such an extensive repudiation of the original as to destroy the credit of the author. That the republication of the book should be forbidden, and that the book should be repudiated in such a way as to save the career of the author as one of the general authorities of the church." Well, this goes on and on through his day books, through various other dates and so on, and referring to things and so on. We now learn, for instance, he says at the tail end of January 60 that Elder McConkie has made corrections and is now preparing a second edition. We don't want him to do that, etc. On January 28, 1960, our Brother McConkie was asked to come into our meeting this morning. When he arrived, I informed him of the desire of the First Presidency with reference to his book not being republished, to which he agreed. Skipping on down, in council meeting with the Quorum of the Twelve, I reported to the brethren our decision regarding Elder McConkie's book, Mormon Doctrine, stating that it has caused considerable comment throughout the church and that it has been a source of concern to the brethren ever since it was published. I said that this book had not been presented to anyone for consideration or approval until after its publication. Let's see. Skipping on here, the First Presidency now indicates that the book shall not be republished, that it not be republished even in a corrected form. That even though Brother McConkie mentions in the book that he takes all responsibility for it, the question has arisen as to whether a public correction should be made. An addendum given concerning the book. It's felt that this would not be wise because Elder McConkie is one of the general authorities and it might lessen his influence. First Presidency, this goes on. I've indicated that we've talked to Elder McConkie. He will not attempt to republish the book, etc. Well, all right. As Tim has indicated, by 1980, Elder McConkie gave a speech at BYU called Seven Deadly Heresies. And heresy number two had to do with evolution. There was difficulty as to whether the speech would be published. Ultimately, it was published, but with heresy number two about evolution having undergone some major corrections. And I had wanted to share with you a three-column comparison of his pulpit manuscript of the transcription as he delivered the speech and as it was then subsequently published, but I'll have to just try to read a couple of those. and give you a flavor for what the difference was. As the speech was delivered, it said, Heresy 2. There are those who say the revealed religion and organic evolution can be harmonized. This is both false and devilish. That's a typical old McConkie approach to things, I think. In the published version, that same passage reads thusly, that same section. Heresy 2 concerns itself with the relationship between organic evolution and revealed religion and asks the question whether they can be harmonized. There are those who believe that the theory of organic evolution runs counter to the plain and explicit principles set forth in the Holy Scriptures, as these have been interpreted by Joseph Smith and his associates. There are others who think that evolution is the system used by the Lord to form plant and animal life and to place man on the earth. Do you notice any difference in that at all? The speech originally makes the continued type statements, the firm, authoritative, you know, sound of the trumpet. The saving doctrine is, you know, try as you may, you cannot harmonize these things, you know, etc. Try as you may, you cannot harmonize the theories of men, etc. All of these are changed to questions now in the published version. Can you harmonize thus or so? Is there any way to harmonize the revealed? These are just questions, he says, that I would like to raise. So the assertions now become questions. And then at the end of that section is a very open statement, which I have not been able to find either by sentiment or anything of substance in any of his other writings. These are questions to which all of us should find answers. Every person must choose for himself what he will believe. I recommend that all of you study and ponder and pray and seek light and knowledge in these and in all fields. That's an insert into the text. Well, others could go on. It seems he's kind of have for the last 3 decades kind of run in 1980 for that one, 1990, now maybe year 2000, but we'll come to that maybe in just a second. I'm running out of time. I've got a list of about 10 or 11 of these private corrections of public statements that we'll try to touch. In 1990, as Tim has indicated, a very prominent general authority gave the last major speech, rather blasting evolution. It's interpreted in a number of ways. Some people say, well, I believe he gave up on everything but evolution for humans. The science people say, well, I wish it were a little more clear if he had done. So it gets read in a variety of ways. What it amounts to, however, was that it was decided that speech would not be published. But since it was the keynote speech for a symposium given down at BYU, the symposium people said, well, you know, it's been our tradition to publish the proceedings of the symposium, and it's a little funny to not put in the keynote address. So eventually it was decided, all right, it will have a keynote address, well, it will be put there, but it will have a formal disclaimer on the top. Now, this is the only time I know of in Mormon history where a general authority has been forced to put a disclaimer on the top. The only thing close was an Orson Pratt speech in 1865. But this one says, disclaimer, only the standard works and statements written under assignment of the First Presidency and the Council of the Twelve Apostles are considered official declarations by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The talk which follows was given without such assignment, and no such approval has been sought or given. The author alone is responsible for the views set forth. They do not necessarily represent the church. Well, by 1992, some of these issues were getting to be sufficiently contentious after decades of it, I guess, at BYU, that Rex Lee decided it was time to put together an official packet of materials that would outline the church's official positions on the subject. And so there was a committee appointed. An official packet was produced. I have copies for them here if you would like to have copies. There's a cover letter. This then was brought together the 1909 and 1925 statements to which Tim has alluded, but it also has a couple of other statements as well. And the cover letter states, this packet contains, as far as could be found, all statements issued by the First Presidency of the Church. There's one exception, and I've put that on the tail end here. This packet, just skipping down, the general question matter of organic evolution as a process for development of biological species has never been addressed by the First Presidency, but these documents will make clear the position of the Church regarding the origin of man, which, as Tim has indicated, is relatively undefined. Various views have been expressed by other Church leaders on this subject over many years. However, formal statements by the First Presidency are the definitive source of official church positions. Now, this is signed by the Board of Trustees, which was, of course, the First Presidency, seven members of the Quorum of the Twelve, and the head of the Young Women and head of CES and so on. This contains four basic documents, and I have then put on the back the final one, and I'll return to that in just a moment. But we're in the year 2000, and the current adult study manual, of course, is that of Joseph F. Smith's teachings. Unfortunately, only the 1909 statement, the rather anti-evolution one, is included in the manual. There was a lot going on with some administration. I talked with a member of the, and it was much, much more open to science than what the 1909 statement even begins to imply. I talked with a member of the writing committee for the manuals and said, you know, how come? Joseph F. himself had statements on the subject in 1909, in April 1910, in December 1910, in April 1911. How come none of this ever got there? We had church manuals like Rational Theology, which were being used in the MIA. The church's first big book on evolution and Mormonism was in 1904 in Joseph F. Smith's administration by his good friend Nelson Nelson from BYU. It's rampant evolution. A very pro-evolutionary book. Why did you miss all this? And this individual says, well, I really don't think we brought ourselves up to speed, frankly, on the subject of science. We really didn't quite think we... It just didn't dawn on us we ought to do that. And I said, well, please be it so dawned for the next one. By the way, who is the next one? And he said, well, I don't want to say because we've had so much publishing of Mormon kitsch on the two we've done on Brigham Young and Joseph F. that we're trying to stop that for the next one. Well, I can appreciate that. However, I would like to share with you the 1909 statement caused some real discussion. And in clarification of that, just 5 months later, in the instructions to the priesthood quorums of the church, was a statement that I think is very profound and really still holds today. This is the last statement that addresses this problem specifically that can be associated with the First Presidency. In just what manner did the mortal bodies of Adam and Eve come into existence on this earth? This comes from several high priests' quorums. Cites Moses, cites Abraham, excuse me. These are the authentic statements of the Scriptures, ancient and modern. It's best to rest with these until the Lord shall see fit to give more light. Three options. Whether the mortal bodies of man evolved in natural processes to present perfection through the direction and power of God, or whether Adam and Eve were transplanted from another sphere, or whether they were born here in mortality as other mortals have been, are questions not fully answered in the revealed Word of God. Leave it. And that is their last and most explicit statement. People who write currently... Oh, the BYU 1992 also saw not only the BYU packet, but also the production of the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. Which statement on evolution, signed by Bill Evanson, was approved by the First Presidency and indeed works from their minutes with materials furnished to the people who published the encyclopedia? And they quote the 1931 statement that we did earlier, kind of leave science to the scientists while we leave while we magnify our calling in the realm of the church. People who write to the church for a church position these days will be given either a shortened version or just a Xerox copy of the encyclopedia statement that says this is the position of the church, which leaves it open. I want to indicate that there will be two books coming out this fall that I think we need to give, to which we need to give publicity. Coming next month is one by Trent Stevens and Jeff Meldrum from up at Idaho State, which will be Evolution and Mormonism, being published by Signature. In October, just in time for Halloween, will be one that exposes a very interesting chapter in church history. After 1931, when the First Presidency told the other brethren to shut up on the subject, Joseph Fielding Smith and James E. Talmage got into a bit of a debate, an ongoing thing, of since they couldn't publish directly, of having others publish for them. It's a fascinating chapter. Joseph Fielding was using some creationists as his surrogates. James E. Talmage had recruited, and he didn't have to do much recruiting, his son Sterling, who was both his intellectual and spiritual heir, PhD in geology, just as James E. was, and very interested in reconciling these things. There was a very interesting subterfuge after James E. Talmage's death, a very interesting subterfuge used to convince Sterling that his father's views had not been approved by the church. I'll leave that for your reading. But Sterling published some things, but there were some things, a number of articles that he wrote that were never published, but will be published in October under the title, Can Faith and Religion, you know, Can Science and Faith Be Reconciled, or something like that. It contains 80-some-odd pages of correspondence between Sterling and the First Presidency and Joseph Fielding Smith and Anthony Ivins. It's going to be a fascinating collection, and so I think this fall we're going to see two major new developments that I hope will have some minor effect, at least, in trying to reverse the tide of conservatism and putting our students into problems that Tim has indicated. Thank you.
Dwayne mentioned Trent Stevens sitting here has got a forthcoming book with Jeffrey Meldrum. He also gave Jeff's paper yesterday in a prior session. It's on tape. And then he gave his own paper that's directly related to this particular issue. We do have some time for maybe one question. If you'd like to step up here, I'm terrible at restating your position.
Jeff, I have a question about 1960. Some of us know how difficult it is to get a book published with Deseret Book or Bookcraft. Certainly, up until just about 2 years ago, at least for Deseret Book, and I thought the case was true also for Bookcraft, there were general authorities on the publishing board. How did Ellen McConkie's book go by with the letters that had been written, if there at that time were general authorities on the board?
It was not republished by Deseret Book. It was republished by Bookcraft.
Yeah,
but Bookcraft. Marvin Wallen, I think, was still the main person down there at that point. Grant, do you have some information?
I worked
at Bookcraft,
and we're selling
bootleg
for
$25.
True story.
But he's never reprimanded. By the time the second edition was published in 1965, President McKay, of course, was well beyond being able to deal with these sorts of issues. And there were a number of others on his plate that just didn't get dealt with in those years. I have tried and tried and tried to find if there was ever any permission for that, and I've just been told repeatedly permission was never even asked. It was just republished. Now, it was republished with major corrections on both Catholicism and on science, but it still cannot be called pro-Catholic, pro-Catholic, or pro-science either. I'll just leave it there. Others? Yes.
Yeah, one quick question.
You have Boyd K. Packer taking a strong stand against evolution, even theistic evolution, but does Boyd K. Packer, what does he say about the geological ideas that we have, the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, and the universe of the stars is about 10 to 15 billion years old. Is he anti those long ages too?
I'm sure to be honest with you. Why don't you take that? Thank you.
I don't know that Elder Packer has ever really directly addressed those. In his speech, The Law and the Life in 1990, Law and the Light, in 1990, there's some ancillary things that you can kind of interpret, but they're not clear. Now, Elder McConkie, of course, gave in on the age of the earth. In the June 1982 issue of the Ensign, you'll find his article, Christ and the Creation, and he finally gives up on the age of the earth and says, you know, how long was the day of creation? It was an eon, a period of time, a section of eternity to get something done, and they were not all the same length of time, et cetera, et cetera. But I have not seen that from him.
It was also Brigham Young. Brigham Young was definitely not an evolutionist, but at the same time he accepted the age of the earth as being millions and millions of years old, which goes along with what Dwayne is saying, that a lot of leaders of the church have accepted the age of the earth without necessarily accepting evolution. So as far as Boyd K. Packer goes, I'm not really sure.
I think we've reached the end. Dwayne, you have these packets if people would like to get a copy of them. Thanks.